All right. Hope everybody had a good lunch. Thanks, Bob and Brad. Had a couple of those chocolate chip and oatmeal cookies. They were pretty good. So Bob asked me to chat about SI joint dysfunction. Any of y'all see that by a show of hands, and any of your athletes? So, yeah. And so we're going to cover the SI joint about as much as we can in 20 minutes. So I'm going to try and give you a little synopsis of the literature that I think when you have bunches of athletes coming in right after class and somebody points to their SI joint and says it hurts, kind of something that you can screen out and determine, is that the lumbar spine, is it the SI joint, and maybe what are some concepts that should guide our treatment or management of it. So I don't have any financial relationships to disclose. This just came out in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. So this isn't in your slides as what was printed out for you, but it's an editorial in this month's edition of British Journal of Sports Medicine. And if you don't read it, I'd highly suggest you just following it or following Peter B. O'Sullivan on Twitter and Karim Khan, their editor. But it's a one-page editorial that just discusses why are athletes treated so different than our current clinical practice guidelines suggest with regards to low back pain. And one thing they really get at is that a lot of people end up getting x-rays and, in particular, MRIs. And we know that the more you scan a patient, the worse their outcomes. So the more money you spend on getting imaging, the worse their outcomes, in particular with low back pain. Because what it does is it elevates their fear. And in relation to the SI joint, it pretty much has no utility. So, or at least none that's been determined thus far. And so they say that our management of low back pain is in sport seems to be to reflect a schizophrenic mixture of minimization, so rest and scanning, intensive therapies, passive treatments, and stabilization exercises, and early use of aggressive treatments such as spinal injections or surgery. So just kind of big picture, the words we use matter and highly influence outcomes. Hey, Kale, will you? Oh, got it. So we're going to talk about the anatomy and biomechanics, the prevalence, pathophysiology, some physical exam procedures, and touch a bit on how do we treat it. And so anatomy and biomechanics, the SI joint is a big force transfer mechanism. So it takes the forces from your feet that pass through your hip and into your spine and efficiently transfer those. And it's an odd-shaped joint. It's said to be a bit auricular in nature. So it's this red shaded area, and it's got this propeller type look to it, and it's thought to change and become much more arthritic in middle age. So mobile when you're a kid, mobile around pregnancy, and then stiffens from that point on. So diarthrodial joint, well stabilized by ligamentous constraints, and remainder of stability is provided by muscular corsets. And so when I say the ligamentous constraints are effective, it takes a lot to actually dislocate an SI joint. So you basically need a high force mechanism like a severe car accident. And what will happen then is they'll put a couple of pins between the iliac wing and the sacrum. And nowadays it's being proposed more as a treatment for SI joint dysfunction, which I haven't seen anything with regards to the outcomes on it. But in general, we don't fuse hips, so I'm not sure we want to fuse SI joints either. Doesn't seem very logical. So we've got a bunch of ligaments, and in particular during palpation, these ligaments here, the long dorsal ligament and sacrotuberous ligaments here, line up well with the force transfer coming from the leg. And so it's said that the sacrotuberous ligament aligns really well with the biceps femoris as far as a force transfer goes. But those posterior ligaments can become tender. So usually your patient will point to their SI joint or PSIS, and if you palpate their long dorsal ligament, there's some evidence to support that that is suggests an SI joint dysfunction. These are the ligaments, so this interosseous ligament is super strong. It's also a bit of a crooked joint, like we talked about earlier. And so just all what this means is it's meant to be a pressure relief valve. It's meant to transfer forces, and it's not something that's meant to have large amounts of movement. Another thing to think about is how your hip socket, which isn't shown here, right, but is about in here with regards to the plane of the body, kind of beneath the lumbar spine. But if you can think about that force is passing around your pelvic ring and then up into your spine. And so if we want to take an older person who has osteoporosis of their spine and help them change that, what we would do is a lot of leg lift, leg exercises that transfer lots of load across it, and that will change the bone density of the lumbar spine. And so with that in mind, things that pass from the floor go up and into the SI joint, which is going to matter in your female young cross-country runners that have hip drop and a lot of bad biomechanics. So speaking of the hips and hip drop, so your glutes are your big supinators, right? They help with external rotation. They keep your knees out, prevent the dynamic knee valgus we see in a lot of our lower extremity athletes. But it's also exactly in line with the lats. So that's one of the slings. So when we think about the SI joint and how we're going to provide stability, or just how we're going to have some biomechanical efficiency, we're thinking of ways that we can work in diagonal patterns. And one way I like to challenge healthy folks or people progressing out of their SI joint dysfunction is to have them do a push-up with dumbbells in their hands, and then they add a row. And so you've got, when you pull your hand up off the ground, so you're here, and you get down, push up, and then when you pull your hand up off the ground, you're causing a diagonal load. And so you're getting a lot of force transfer across that joint, and that helps facilitate that stability. So if you want to really feel your obliques kick in, trying something like that is great. And you also have your anterior sling with your adductors and your internal obliques and your abdominal fascia. And once again, when you walk, as your leg goes behind you and as your leg goes in front of you, you're going to get micro movement of the SI joint. But if you ever have somebody x-ray your pelvis and say, oh, well, your ASIS is, sorry about that, your ASIS, your ASIS is off, don't believe them. Okay, there's no good effective way to measure what your iliac crests are doing on imaging because you lay a little bit off each time. You clench one of your butt cheeks because you're cold or something like that. It's going to throw the imaging off. But it's a great way to scare the hell out of people and get at least poor outcomes or lots of visits from your athlete. And so this is a look at, I'm sure y'all see some of these different postures in the training room, right? Y'all see linemen walk in and they're waddling their butt back and forth, right? And so their spondylolisthesis is about to happen at any given moment here. And then you have your cross-country runners that don't have a butt at all. And they kind of get pulled along by their hamstrings. So neither one of those are real effective, and neither one of those are particularly good on your SI joint. But both of those are reasons to also screen the lumbar spine before you move down to the SI joint. And then seated postures like this. So all of this plays with your ilium, and all of this is going to put different stresses across your SI joint. And then it's going to wiggle you when you walk, and that's normal, and we want some movement. And then from a biomechanical standpoint, this is what our abs are meant to do, right? our muscles and our fascia are meant to produce stiffness when you're lifting heavy loads, which is why you hold your breath before you do an Olympic lift. Your blood pressure goes through the roof, but your spinal stability, instead of being the width of your spinal column, becomes the width of your body by holding your breath. And you transfer energy. So throwing a baseball, your spine has to be a little bit like a slinky, right? You need your pelvis, your hips to dissociate from what your shoulders are doing to be able to generate velocity. And then we're also trying to recover elastic energy. And then this is pretty cool. If we think about our abs, there's some very good relationship to what our meniscus does. So the bottom right here, we've got our meniscus, and we're taking a vertical force, so the weight of our body landing down under our heel or cutting or jumping, and we've got this triangular spacer here, our meniscus. And with a downward force, the meniscus wants to extrude out, wants to literally pop out of the joint. But because it's anchored by the roots here, that force pushing out becomes a what we call hoop stress. So it takes a vertical force and makes it spread out efficiently, okay? Well, that's the same thing that our abs do. So our abs, we've got the strap muscles in the front, the rectus, and we've got the strap muscles in the back, your erectors. So those are your vertical struts. Then you have your diagonal struts, right? Your internal and external obliques. And then you have a completely horizontal muscle, the transverse abdominis. So you've got something going in every direction to support your rib cage to your pelvis. And so what we do is we take vertical loads and we transform them into diagonal loads that can be dispersed, like between the lats and the glutes. So anyway, so I thought that was pretty cool, kind of as I was reading through the literature, thinking about how our spine and the meniscus have some real commonalities. And then just notice how much fascia is here. So if we think of this fascia to some degree like a tendon, not quite as good as the Achilles, but it's meant to be able to store energy. And so we have to be able to engage that with our glutes and our lats. On the front side, if we think about our rectus, it's like a hamstring with little spacers in it. But these spacers tell you that this muscle isn't meant to produce a crunching motion, right? If it was meant to create movement, it would be long just like a hamstring and not have these little intermuscular tendons or septums in it. What it's designed to do is keep you from getting pushed backwards like this. So it's literally an anti-extension muscle. So when somebody hits you or you hit somebody else, you don't get a big energy leak. So if I go to hit somebody, the force, like say I bench 500 pounds, which I definitely don't, but say I do and I want to go hit somebody with that force and my limiting factor is my abs and I just bend backwards, I'm only imparting half of that because I've leaked out through my kinetic chain because my abs are my limiting factor. So the rectus is meant to keep you from getting pushed backwards, probably only if you're a gymnast and a few other sports, does this actually help you create movement? Whoa, sorry about that. And then the lats I've mentioned a few times, but they're a natural back brace. So the way they invest into this thoracolumbar fascia, when you're deadlifting, as this guy is doing here, you're taught to put your squeeze your shoulder blades down and back and engage your lats, and that engages the fascia. And it's easy to see on this guy and hard to see on most normals. But working lats is useful as you try and stabilize the SI joint. And this is just a simple look at the force transfer mechanism, the vectors being passed around the pubic ring through the SI joint into the lumbar spine and vice versa. Sorry, I'm trying to figure out the exact magic touch here. There we go. All right, so there's a couple different ways to provide stability. So there's the thought of the form closure, and the form closure has a lot to do with that propeller shape and the odd auricular shape of the SI joint. The other way is by force closure, which is like we've talked about, the lats and the glutes, the transverse abdominis, and these diagonal patterns. So prevalence and pathomechanics. So sports is risky. Some risks are just funny and others are more serious. The nice thing about the SI joint is while it can seriously impair function, it's not serious as in it's not going to progress and turn into something that's going to give you drop foot or anything like that. All right, more risks of back pain. So it's prevalent. I know y'all see it in the training room. I know when I help out at U of H, there's always a number of folks that are dealing with back pain or SI joint pain of some type. So it's really common during pregnancy, and most of the time it resolves, but there's a lingering 8 to 15% that's thought to not resolve. And then as far as athletes, they're relatively unstudied, but athletes that are thought to be at risk are those with asymmetrical loads. So baseball players, golfers, running is a repeated single leg activity, so that's asymmetrical. And there's some idea that younger athletes, those who are going through growth spurts, may be a little more at risk because their lever arms are getting longer and their strength doesn't catch up for a while, so there's that delay. I was trying to teach my 7-year-old how to squat. My 2-year-old does a beautiful squat, and my 4-year-old is okay, and my 7-year-old about to turn 8 is terrible, and I can't figure out what happened, but she's just getting taller and taller, and her strength doesn't match. She can run fine, but you ask her to squat, and she's literally all over the place, and the motor pattern changes with each repetition. So there's not a lot to coach there. She's just got to be a kid and play around, but for whatever reason, at 8 or 7, you can take your kid into the gym at the Y, and you don't have to leave him in the daycare. And so I promised she could go, and so she spent a lot of time on the bike because otherwise I couldn't do anything. So anyway, so pathomechanics, we've kind of hit this quite a bit. Physical exam. So what physical exam test should we do? Any suggestions? Any favorites? All right, so the first thing is if they point to that area highlighted in the rectangle, they might have SI joint pain, right? So between the PSIS and the ischial tube or the sacral tuberous ligament. All right, so generally speaking, it stays above the knee as far as the pain referral pattern. Ooh. So these are a couple of mechanisms of injury, right? Tiger Woods, among other injuries, that extension, right, hyperextension and rotation under a load with a lot of speed, it's not healthy for the back. I've seen a good number of volleyball players who struggle to arch. They don't have the eccentric strength of their abs to truly arch back and then go into a pike. Not to mention that, but the landing loads that they have. And then in our biomechanics lab, we see a lot of people who run and their feet are swinging out to the side, which means their knees are coming in. And anytime you land in that position, your pelvis is gonna flip-flop all over the place. So when the knee comes in, so you tear your ACL if you're in a high-speed sport, and if you're in a jogging thing, then the opposite side pelvis is gonna drop, and that's gonna cause pain in your hip or your SI joint or your back. So more about history and complaints. Usually it's with movement and transitional movements in particular, going up and down stairs, jumping, running, playing sports. So we assume it's the back until proven otherwise, and then we can assume it's the hip until proven otherwise. We rule out the joint above and below it, and then we get to the SI joint, and then we simply work through provocation tests. There's 4 of them. Then we palpate the area, and then we can do what's called an active straight leg raise test and see if they need stability. All right, so distraction, thigh thrust, compression. You can use Fabers as well and Gainslands, and so I think I have pictures on the next slide. So the big hitters are here, the distraction top left and thigh thrust top right. If those two are negative, you probably don't have an SI joint issue. The other 3 are part of a cluster that can help you define if it's an SI joint issue. And then your active straight leg raise test. So you've all seen and had your athletes do a straight leg raise. And so what you can do is you can do a straight leg raise see if it hurts the SI joint. And then what you do is you compress their pelvis, provide them some artificial stability, and then have them lift the leg again and see if that takes the pain away. And if it does, then you think, all right, well, maybe I can stabilize it. And technically, being that you've passively stabilized it, so maybe an SI belt might help. I'd avoid those if you can. And then what you can try is this test where you essentially have them do a straight leg raise, but you're resisting, if I'm lifting my left leg, you're resisting the contralateral shoulder. And if that takes the pain away, then you know their force, if they actively create force across those diagonals, that their SI joint doesn't hurt. And so that lets you know that you can help them actively stabilize to solve this problem. So treatment. All right, so manipulation. Normally I'll start and manipulate the thoracic spine, knowing that a lot of people are sitting at desk and have forward head posture. Then I showed this manipulation on the bottom right in lab. And then this is a great article. If you Google Van Tolder, I can get it to Bob. But basically there is a phased approach to rehab. And so you're trying to figure out their lordosis. So get them into a neutral spine, get him to load transfer, getting him in good alignment and standing, and then single leg standing, and then getting after their aggravating postures or their sport. So phase one, you might do breathing exercises, abdominal drawing in maneuver. So that's called crocodile breathing. There's some good videos on how to do that online. Holding your breath, right, provides more stability, but you don't get to choose when you hold your breath in sports. You can do planking and start against the wall and then progress to horizontal. And noticing how runners need to lock in the rib cage, that picture on the far left, okay. And then McGill crunch, side plank, and bird dogs are great places to start. And then let me wrap up here. Hip hinging. And then you get into fun stuff like the push-up row. Most of your athletes aren't going to be getting to this point outside of maybe the physio ball rollout. Having them do RDLs, but doing an airplane where they open and close. Working on squatting. And then getting counter rotation. So Palloff press, those of you who aren't familiar with that, that's very fun and easy to teach. And then getting into single leg activities and double limb activities, and then developing power and speed, and then playing tug of war with towels is a ton of fun. So they don't know when you're gonna pull on the towel, and they try and keep their feet locked into that spot. And then working on medicine ball throws and things like this. So how do you get from low level activity to activities that more mimic their issues? So anyway, these are a couple other articles I highly recommend. Pain Science helps you pick words because they matter with your patients. And it's all about athletes and low back pain. And then Harvey et al., they're from Texas Children's, wrote about lumbar injuries in the pediatric and adolescent pain population. So anyway, I appreciate your time and hope you have a good conference today and tomorrow.